Okay, welcome back. We've been off for 2 weeks. Wanted to dedicate, as we mentioned, tonight's shiur to Hanukkah, and because Hanukkah is coming up, of course, and specifically to talk about 3 points. I want to make 3 points tonight. None of them are my own. In going through a bunch of svarim just before Hanukkah, I chanced once again upon the Ars Kol Hanukkah book by Rabbi Hirsch Goldworm, Zichrono Livracha. Rabbi Goldworm, who I didn't know personally, but is responsible for some of the early Art School publications, was a tremendous Talmud Chacham who was a Malamed Tinokus. Basically started off, I think, as an elementary school teacher until Art School discovered him.
Rabbi Goldworm.
Yeah, did you know him personally?
I know the family.
But apparently, as we can see from his writings, not only was he a Talmud Chacham in the traditional sense of the term, you know, with Shas and Mefarshim and the like, but had an incredibly broad knowledge of history and all different kinds of, you know, the quote-unquote lighter Torah disciplines, which, of course, they're called lighter because we don't know them, so we call them lighter. But he had a very good sense of history as expressed through a variety of different sources. And specifically when it comes to Hanukkah, that knowledge of history is very, very important, because one of the holidays which we probably know least about from a historical perspective is Hanukkah. There's obviously nothing in Tanakh about Hanukkah. The stories of Hanukkah come after the Tanakh was closed. And even what we have from Chazal and Midrashim is a piece here, a piece there. Chazal, for a variety of different reasons, played down a lot of the history of the period, choosing to focus on the one event, the miracle of the Pach HaShemen, of the oil, and the halachas and the hashkafas of Hanukkah, but so much of the history they don't really get into. Much of our historical information is from 4 apocryphal books, known as the Books of the Maccabees, which were originally written in Greek and Latin, and only afterwards translated into Hebrew and to other languages. They do seem to be authoritative. They do seem to date back a long time. And much of what we know, just in terms of the back and forth in the history, is based on those books. What I want to present tonight is really 3 points, all of which I think are original, that Rabbi Goldworm presents in the Art Scroll Hanukkah book. One of them is just stam interesting. I don't know that there's so much hashkafa that we can get out of it, but it's an interesting, it helps us understand Rashi and Chumash, so that's always a good thing. Two of the points, I think, are not just interesting from a historical point of view, but also shed a certain light on the hashkafa that surrounds Hanukkah. When you understand the history well, it can help you understand the hashkafa of what it is that that we're celebrating. Just Erech Agav, before we get into the points, so the book itself has a haskama from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and apparently this was not just like a typical haskama. You know, most haskamas, if you read them, to most svarim, read something along the lines of, the fellow brought me the sefer, I didn't really have time to look at it, but I know that the mechaber is a wonderful person, and I'm sure that the sefer is a wonderful sefer, and you should definitely buy it, even though I looked at it maybe for 30, 40 seconds. Here it's a very, very different type of haskama. Apparently Rav Goldworm sat with Rabbi Yaakov for a duration of time. Rabbi Yaakov himself was also a Talmud Chacham, a Gadol B'Yisrael, who also had a very broad knowledge of a lot of different Torah disciplines, so to speak. He was very well versed in history and sciences and the like. And apparently many of the conclusions that Rabbi Goldworm comes to in the Sefer were bounced off of Rabbi Yaakov before printing, so to an extent it's more of a real haskama than just a pro forma haskama. In the haskama he writes, Dover Choshev Ma'od Kibel Kavodo Al Atzmo. He addresses the haskama to Rabbi Goldworm himself, and he writes, it's a very choshev thing that you accepted upon yourself, L'chaber Perek Miuchad Al Historia Shel Tkufa Sanes. The fact that you decided to write a special chapter about the history of the period of the miracle is extraordinary. Aruch al haderech shiitzia kavodo lefonai. And you put it together in the way in which you described to me you were going to put it together. Hatkufa yeshva harbe inyanim stumim umisubachim. The period has many issues which are hard to understand and complicated. Hameorim tmios. that bring about questions. V'hi eino yidua af l'rov yodei sefer v'tamidei chachamim. And even people who were Talmidei Chachamim, who were Torah scholars, don't really know a lot about the period in which Chanukah took place. V'alkein yesher chelo shiyamo levarir hamikoros v'yisader dover dover la'ofano toeles hamon b'nei Torah. Right, and therefore you should be blessed because you took upon yourself this task, which is, you know, not an easy task. Right, a little bit different than the typical haskama. All right, so let's talk about these 3 points. Start with the Rashi and Chumash. All right, so Rashi at the pasuk at the very end of Chumash in Parshas Vezosa Bracha talks about the brachos that Moshe Rabbeinu was giving out to the various Shvatim. And to Levi, Moshe Rabbeinu gives the following bracha. Borech Hashem Chelo, Kodesh Baruch Hu should bless his chayil, his army, Ufo'al Yodov Tirtze, and the work of his hands, of Levi's hands, should be accepted. Mechatz Mosnayim Komov U'misanov Min Yakumun. Levi should have the ability to smash the loins of those who rise up against him, and to oppress and put down his enemies. So it's an interesting bracha. We know that Levi is involved with the Avodas HaMikdosh, you know, getting involved in the Beis HaMikdosh. He wasn't really a military man. If anything, the Levim didn't go to war. So what's all this talk of Mechatz Mosraim Komov Mesanov Min Yekumun? The enemies are going to rise up against Levi, and Levi is going to be blessed by Moshe Rabbeinu that he can put them down. So says Rashi, right in Chumash, Mechatz Mosraim Komov, Ra'a she'osidin chashmonoi uvonov lehilochem im hayivonim. This is a prophetic reference to the Chanukah story. Moshe Rabbeinu saw that Chashmonoi and his sons were going to fight the Yevonim, the Greeks, v'yispalil aleihem lefi shehayu mu'otim, and he davened that Chashmonoi and his sons should be able to defeat the Greeks, because after all, the Greeks were a huge army, and Chashmonoi and his sons were a very limited force. How many sons did Chashmonoi have? Right? So we all know. Matisyo and his 5 sons. And we went to the Chanukah play. Come on, you know. I mean, it's, you know. So Yehuda was one. What's that?
More than once.
Yehuda, Yochanan, Yonasan, Shimon, and Elazar. Right? The 5 sons of Matisyo, Kohen Gadol. How do we know their names? Well, basically, they're told to us in the book of Maccabees. That's where we get that information from. There's nowhere, to the best of my knowledge, there's nowhere in Shas Midrashim or the like, in the Talmud or the Midrashim, where Matisyahu and his 5 sons are actually identified, or the 5 sons of Matisyahu are actually identified. Whatever knowledge we have of their names comes from these apocryphal books. But lo and behold, you keep reading Rashi, and Rashi, without missing a beat, tells us something totally different. How many sons did Chashmonoi have? Yud Beis B'nei Chashmonoi Ve'elozer K'neged Kama Rivavos. You know, the 12 sons of Chashmonoi and Elazar were stacked up against tens of thousands of Greek soldiers without missing a beat. You know, without even telling you that anything's amiss, Rashi talks about, yeah, come on, everybody knows that, the 12 sons of Chashmonoi. L'chach ne'mar, Baruch Hashem chelo, fo'a yodov tirtze. That's what the pasuk means, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should enable Chashmonoi and his 12 sons to be victorious against the Greek armies. Chashmonoi and his 12 sons. Okay, so maybe you'll say Pshat in Vermaisa, where Rashi lived. So they had to shtup a lot of kids into the Chanukah skit. So maybe the Mora said, yeah, he had 12 sons. Right? So this way everybody gets a part. So everybody's going to be happy. Okay, that's one Pshat.
Make more latkes.
Okay, so maybe that's pshat. But somehow I think we feel intuitively that there's something lacking over there. Chashmonoi, there's 12 sons? Where'd that come from? And how come nobody talks about that? Right? And how come a Rashi on Chumash is apparently given less credence, I mean there's no other way to say it, than an apocryphal book that was written in Greek and Latin. So in other words, the book that was written in Greek that talks about five sons of Matisyahu, that everybody knows and we all accept as Torah Misinai, quote unquote, so to speak, as authoritative. But a Rashi on Chumash, and it's not just the Rashi on Chumash, Rashi quotes this pshat from a Medrash Tanchuma. So a Medrash of Chazal that identifies 12 sons of Chashmonai, that we sweep under the carpet, we don't talk about, and it just kind of, you know, if it were not for the fact that we try to be Mavri Sedra, you'd miss this Rashi entirely. How can we miss this Rashi? Because it's in Vezos HaBracha. Right? How many people get to be Mavri Sedra of Vezos HaBracha? Simchas Torah, ooh, things are a little bit frailish that time of year. Right? So that's how everybody overlooks this Rashi, but it's there, you can look, you don't have to take my word for it. You can look in the Chumash with Rashi and see that it's right there. So how do we reconcile that? Did he have 12 sons? Or did he have 5 sons? So Rabbi Goldworm wants to suggest something, which I took a look at it, and I was astounded, but it not only helps us understand this Rashi, it helps a couple of other Mekoros as well. Let me read to you from a Gemara, Masechta Megillah, right? This again, you know, it's on every shelf, it's in every Shas, it's not like something far out there or something like that. The Pasuk, Megillah Daf Yud Aleph Amid Aleph, quotes a Pasuk from Vayikra. The Pasuk in Vayikra at the end of the Tochacha gives a Pasuk of reassurance that it says that even when the Jews are Be'eretz Oyveihem, Lo Ma'astim V'lo Ge'altim L'chalosam, I haven't rejected the Jews, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, I haven't despised the Jews, I haven't thrown out the Jews, L'hofer Brisi Itam, I'm not going to break my covenant with them, Ki Ani Hashem Elokeihem, I, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, am going to maintain my covenant, my bris, with the Jewish people, despite their being in Golos. So, comments the Gemara, Lo me'astim b'mei Yevonim, v'lo ge'altim b'mei Nebuchadnezzar. Right? I haven't, what the Pasuk is referring to, is that even when the Jews are in Golos, God still remains attached to the Jewish people, specifically during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, when the Babylonians are controlling the Jews. And during the time of the Greeks, God still maintains his connection with the Jews. How so? So writes the Gemara, V'lo ge'altim b'mei Yevanim, I haven't rejected them during the time of the Greeks. Shehem mariti lohem shimon hatzadik, I appointed for the Jewish people Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik was the Kohen Gadol when Alexander the Great marched against Yerushalayim. And Shimon HaTzadik, as the Gemara says, went out to greet Alexander the Great when he came to Yerushalayim. Alexander was blown away, because he had constantly seen this vision of Shimon HaTzadik in his dreams, and Shimon HaTzadik would lead him on to victory. So overawed by Shimon HaTzadik, Alexander spared Yerushalayim, and in gratitude, all the boys born that year were named Alexander. Right. Mm-hmm. Whether they were named Alexander Ziskin, I don't know, but they were named at least Alexander during that year. Okay, good. So the Ribbono Shel Olam sent Shimon HaTzadik to help us withstand the Greeks, and V'chashmonoi Uvanov Umatisya Kohen Gadol, and he sent Chashmonoi and his sons and Matisya Kohen Gadol. Now, we usually assume that Matisyahu and his sons, and that the term Chashmonoi is a family name of sorts which describes Matisyahu. In other words, Chashmonoi is what's translated in English as the Hasmoneans, right? We assume that Matisyahu and his 5 sons had a family name, Chashmonoi, and that's why the Malchus, the kingdom, which they ultimately set up, was the Malchus based Chashmonoi, what's called in English the Hasmonean kingdom. Right? In other words, their mail, you know, so to speak, if Matisyahu got mail, it would be addressed to Matisyahu Chashmonoi. Right? And, you know, Yehuda Chashmonoi, Shimon Chashmonoi, etc. But that doesn't fit the way the Gemara presents it. Chashmonoi Uvanov Umatisyahu Kohen Gadol. Sounds like there's this person called Chashmonoi, and he has sons, And that's distinct from Matisyahu Kohen Gadol. Right? The Chashmonoi is not a family name, but it's an individual's name by the name of Chashmonoi. And, you know, this person, Chashmonoi, is not the same person as Matisyahu Kohen Gadol. In there are other versions of this Gemara where they bring the following version of the text. And again, it just underscores the point we're about to bring out. These versions of the text have Matisyahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol v'chashmonoi uvanov. Matisyahu ben Yochanan the Kohen Gadol and Chashmonoi and his children. So says Rabbi Goldworm, well, if you read this Gemara with either version, either the version we have printed in the Gemara or the alternative version, it sounds like there were two people. There was a man by the name of Matisyahu, who might have had five sons, and there was another man by the name of Chashmonoi, who Rashi might be telling us, had 12 sons. And they were both instrumental in the revolt against the Greeks, right? And they were probably related to one another, because after all, the sons of Matisyahu, who are described as taking over the leadership of the Jewish people, ultimately produced this monarchy called the Malchus Beis Chashmonoi, so they couldn't have been totally unrelated to one another. But in other words, Chashmonoi is not just a descriptive of the family as a whole, it's not just the family name, so to speak, it's the name of a certain individual by the name of Chashmonoi, who together with Matisyahu was a leader in the rebellion against the Greeks. So now we have an answer to Rashi and Chumash. Rashi, if you read Rashi carefully, Rashi never talks about Matisyahu. Rashi makes reference to Chashmonoi Uvanov. Rosha Sidin Chashmonoi Uvanov Lilochim Im HaYuvanim. And then he makes reference to Yudbeis B'nei Chashmonoi. So before we had this insight from the Gemara Megillah, I would have said, okay, Chashmonoi means the Hasmonean, you know, with the direct article. It's a reference to Matisyahu, and it means Matisyahu ha-Chashmonoi, Matisyahu the Hasmonean. But now Rabbi Goldworm is suggesting, no, it means something totally different. There was a man, his proper name was Chashmonoi, and he had 12 sons, and don't confuse him, and he was also from Shevet Levi, don't confuse him with, let's say for argument's sake, his cousin, Matisyahu, who was the Kohen Gadol, who had five sons, who was also involved in this fight against the Greeks. And to buttress this point, which again sounds strange and sounds weird, but does fit for the Rashi and does fit for the Gemara, Rabbi Goldworm directs our attention to something which we all know and we say throughout Chanukah. Right, we say the tefillah of Al Hanisim, Bimei Matisyahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Chashmonoi Uvanov. Now, if you look now, the way we have the tefillah, well, I'm sorry.
Should be a comma.
Oh no! So the way we read that particular prayer is as follows: in the days of Matisyahu, the son of Yochanan, the Kohen Gadol, the Chashmonoi, comma. Uvanov, and in the days of his sons, Kishon de Malchus Yavan Harashah, you know, that's when the Greeks fought against the Jews, etc., etc., etc. The whole story is told over there. But if you look in the earliest source of that tefillah, the earliest source of that tefillah is a tractate called Maseches Sofrim. Maseches Sofrim is a compilation of, what's called one of the Masechtos Ketanos, the little tractates. It's not part of the Mishnah, but the material in Maseches Sofrim dates to approximately the same time as the Mishnah. It's written in the same style as the Mishnah. And a lot of what we do today is based on Maseches Sofrim. Maseches Sofrim describes at some length a lot of the tefillos which we use in Shul today, and a lot of them find their source, their earliest source in Maseches Sofrim. If you look in Maseches Sofrim, and again, you don't have to go running off to the Vatican Library or anything of that nature. All you got to do is pull Maseches Sofrim in the standard edition off the shelf. The version of Maseches Sofrim of Alanism, and that's the earliest source where it appears, is as follows: Bimei Matisyahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol v'chashmonoi uvanov. Right. In the days of Matisyahu, the son of Yochanan, the Kohen Gadol, and Chashmonoi and his sons. right? So I took a look. I couldn't believe it. I took a look at Maseches Sofrim. So Maseches Sofrim is printed with a whole bunch of commentaries on the bottom, including the Vilna Gaon, who usually calls our attention to different texts and things like that. So I'm looking, okay, somebody's going to point out that the Vav shouldn't be there, that it's a scribal error or something of that nature. Nobody takes it out. Right? The version of Al HaNisim in Maseches Sofrim is with a Vav, which can only be read as Matisyo Kohen Gadol and Chashmonoi and his sons. Right? Which, again, if you go back to the Gemara and Megillah, is exactly what the Gemara and Megillah is saying. Chashmonoi Uvanov Umatisyo Kohen Gadol. Right? They're two different people. There's Matisyo, there's Chashmonoi. They were probably related to one another. They're probably from the same family, because ultimately it's the Hasmonean dynasty. Right, but they are two different people. They both play a role in the fight against the Greeks, and all the contradictions are resolved. There's Matisyo and his five sons, Chashmonoi and his 12 sons, and they're all taking on the Greeks together. So fascinating, right? I mean, it puts
that we have come this far without knowing.
Right. I mean, but it may be a very basic aspect of the story. By the way, next time they put on the Hanukkah play, you've got an extra 13 rolls, right? It's not even like you have an extra 7 rolls. You have an extra 13 rolls. Chashmonoi and the 12 sons, right? I mean, now we don't have to make the kids, you know, like Greek foot soldiers anymore. They could be the real. They could be heroes. Everybody could be a hero.
What does the word Chashmonoi mean?
He quotes in one of the footnotes that there may be source for the idea of Chashmanim as being lords or officers. There may be a usage of that in Hebrew. So Chashmonoim may just be lords or the like. I think he quotes another suggestion, because nobody really knows. He quotes another suggestion that it may refer to a certain place that they came from. And nowadays, obviously, there's a place called Chashmonoim in Eretz Yisrael, but Chashmonoim in Eretz Yisrael today is named after the Chashmonoim. But I mean, the original name may indicate some kind of place which we're not aware of anymore.
Nothing to do with Levim or Kohanim.
I don't think so. I don't know what the connection would be exactly.
Chashmonaim, the Chashmanim, the shnei dvarim.
Well, so he wants
Chashmonaim is Hashem. The Chashman is an officer.
Right. So he wants to claim that the things may be the same. In most sur, Yevonim nikbitzu alai azai bimei Chashmanim. Right, so there we don't say Chashmonoim, we say Bimei Chashmanim. Now that may be poetry, right? So poetry, you know, you can get away with things, but still, it does point to the fact that maybe Chashmonoim is just a more elaborate form of the word Chashmanim, you know, officers or lords or something of that nature.
But the people who then, the sons and their descendants, who then took on the kingdom for the next 200 years, were they from the Chashmonaim or from Matisyahu?
Well, so what we're suggesting is that it was the same family. I mean, because otherwise, you're right. I mean, clearly the original successors, you know, the original rulers are from the family Matisyahu, but the whole dynasty is called the Malchus Beis Chashmonoi. So what we're suggesting is that Chashmonoi and Matisyahu, let's say for argument's sake, were cousins. So in other words, which makes sense, it's all one big family of Kohanim who were rebelling against the Greeks, and somehow the dynasty took the name from Chashmonoi. They're not called the Matisyahus, right? And they're called the Chashmonoim. You know, but they took the family name, or the name of the dynasty, from this individual Chashmonoi, who had 12 sons. So even though the 12 sons don't seem to be significant in terms of taking over the monarchy, but I guess Chashmonoi as an individual lent his name to the family dynasty.
Now, was any of this mentioned in the books of the Maccabees?
So to the best of my knowledge, no. You know, so again, it's a certain degree of conjecture, but it ends up, I mean, we've seen there are three of our traditional Makoros, a Rashi and Chumash, a Gemara, a Maseches Sofrim, that work very nicely, and in fact are kind of hard to interpret otherwise, you know, unless you work with this idea that there's a Matisyo and a Chashmonoi, and they're not the same person. And maybe that's what we're even saying, and when you go back to our version of Al HaNisim, maybe that's what we're saying every day in Hanukkah as well, meaning with the Vav, like it says in Maseches Sofrim, it's clearly two people. But even without the Vav, it could still be two people, just a comma. B'mei Matisyahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol, Kama, Chashmonoi, Kama, Uvano. The truth is, if you were writing the sentence in English, that's how you'd write it. In the days of Matisyo, the Kohen Gadol, Kama, Chashmonoi, Kama, and his sons, right? You put the and only before the last noun in the sentence.
And there's no right? mention of any names of this Chashmonoi?
No. So.
Does he say anything about why the number comes out to 17 instead of like 18 high?
Oh, that I don't know. Mm-hmm. That I don't know. In Gematria, you can be off by one. It's okay.
Get another
B. In Gematria, yeah, you can be off by one in Gematria. It's the magic rule of Gematria. So it comes out to 17 as opposed to... That's what they say, you know, the Gematria of Choland comes out to the Gematria of Shabbos. Aye, it doesn't work out, so have a little more Choland. And it will work out. Right? So, you know, so... But even our version of Al HaNisim, which we say, we've been saying, you know, since time immemorial... That might be what we're saying. We might be acknowledging, even though we don't realize it, we might be acknowledging the role of Matisyahu, Chashmonoi, and his sons, which would be fascinating. Again, I don't know if you can prove it, but it's a fascinating thought. You know, a very new way of looking at something which we say every day, you know, during the course of Hanukkah. Okay, so that's historical point number one. I don't know if there's a hashkafa to be gleaned from that necessarily, but it certainly is a fascinating insight into a lot of things which we're used to saying on a regular basis. Second issue, when exactly did the story of Hanukkah take place? Well, it seems like a simple enough issue, because the Book of Maccabees tells us when the story of Hanukkah took place. In 1st Maccabees, it makes reference to the Jewish year, which would be the equivalent of the year 165 BCE, as being the year in which the Chanukas HaMikdash, you know, the rededication of the Beis HaMikdash took place. Let's do the Cheshbon for a minute, 1 second. I'll tell you. What's that? I'll tell you in a minute. I'm very bad with dates, but... Give you the exact Jewish date.
BCE.
3597.
Yes, before the Christian era.
3597. So what does that come out to? 3597. You'll figure out the Russian thing. Right? So that's 165 BCE. So when I think of it, it's, for better or for worse, it's easier for me in the secular dates because I think about the secular history at the time. So 165 BCE, that's the date which is given in Maccabees. And if you look in any, just about any standard history on the story of Hanukkah, so that's the date which is given. The problem is, if you look in Chazal, the impression one gets from Chazal, the superficial impression one gets from Chazal, I want to underline superficial, the superficial impression one gets from Chazal is that the events of Hanukkah actually took place at least 25 years later than that. Why do I say that? Well, because there's a very old work of Jewish history which is attributed to one of the Tanoim, Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta, known as the Seder Olam. Mm-hmm. Right? The Seder Olam is the basis for most of the dating which we have for all of Jewish history, or all of world history. I mean, all of the things which we were taught way back when in terms of how to figure out, you know, who was born when and who died when, is all based on the Seder Olam. Rashi and Chumash consistently quotes the Seder Olam. I mean, just to give one very famous example from the Seder Olam, we know that the Yetzias Mitzrayim, or the duration of the time that the Jews spent in Egypt, is described in Chumash as being 400 years in duration, right? And another place is described as 430 years in duration. And yet we have a Kabbalah that the Jews were only in Mitzrayim for 210 years. So how do you reconcile that? So the answer which we all learned, which is in Rashi, that Yecheshben, the 400 years from the birth of Yitzchak, and Yecheshben, the 430 years from the Bris Bein Habsarim, right? That's a Seder Olam. That's that was the first source to make such a statement, you know, which, by the way, if you work it out, means that the Bris Bein Habsarim took place 5 years before Lech Lecha. Right? If you do the math, it places Avram Avinu as being 70 years old at the Bris Bein Habsarim. The Pasuk in Chumash says that when God told him Lech Lecha, he was 75. So you come up with this sort of strange scenario where Lech Lecha was actually the second time that Avram Avinu went to Eretz Yisrael. He must have been there at the age of 70, because the Bris Bein Habsarim, which says I'm going to give you this land, you know, took place when Avram Avinu was 70, according to the Seder Olam. Okay, so that's just stam. You have to, you know, wrap your head around that for a little bit. But Al Kapanim, the Seder Olam is generally considered to be our authoritative source for Jewish history, going back to the Tanoim. So the Gemara Maseches Avodah Zarah quotes quotes the Seder Olam as saying the following. Says the Seder Olam, the Roman rule of Eretz Yisrael began 103 years before the Churban, and the Malchus Beis Hashmonai began 103 years before that. So in other words, if you took advanced mathematics way back when, the beginning of the Malchus Beis Hashmonai is 206 years prior to the Churban. Right? Now, offhand, I would say the beginning of the Malchus Beis Hashmonai means when the Hanukkah story happened. Right? That's when the Jews overthrew the Greeks, right? Or at least threw the Syrian Greeks out of Eretz Yisrael. They started their own monarchy, the Malchus Beis Hashmonai, the Hasmonean dynasty. And from that point to the Churban Bayis Sheni, to the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, is 206 years. That says the Seder Olam. Now let's make a cheshbon a little bit. Generally speaking, we assume that the Churban Bayis Sheni took place in 68 CE. Right, the sum 68, 69, sometimes people say 70. Right, it seems more accurate if you look in the Jewish sources, it was 68. But let's work with 68 for a moment. If you work backwards 206 years from 68, and you have to just remember there is no year zero, so just factor that in when you do the math, right? You end up at the year 139 BCE, 139 before the Common Era. Right? Now, again, the Book of Maccabees identifies the story of Hanukkah taking place in 165 BCE. Again, some 26 years before that, right? So again, how do you reconcile all of this? You have the Book of Maccabees saying it happened in 165. Mm-hmm. You have the Seder Olam dating the beginning of the Hasmonean dynasty, the Malchus Beis Hashmonai, to 139 BCE, right? So there seems to be at least a 26 year discrepancy as to when the story of Hanukkah took place. Is there any way to put all of these pieces together? Right? So, some historians on both sides of the divide, right? Some classical Frum historians have said, okay, well, there's no contradiction here. Seder Olam beats out the Book of the Maccabees. All right, so Seder Olam is right. The Book of the Maccabees is wrong. We're not obligated to embrace the Book of the Maccabees as Torah Misinai, right? It's an apocryphal book or apocryphal series of books. So even though it gives a date, and even though the Book of Maccabees seems to date back a very, very long time, it seems to be a pretty accurate historical source. But okay, so we follow the Seder Olam. Lahavdil, if you read secular historians, so they take the opposite approach. Okay, well, so the Book of the Maccabees, they say, is the more historically accurate source. I, the Seder Olam, okay, so, you know, Machlokas Seder Olam, the Book of the Maccabees. So the secular historians will embrace the Book of the Maccabees over the Seder Olam. Rabbi Goldworm suggests that everybody's correct. So you say, everybody's correct. How can everybody be correct? Right? But he says the following, and I think it really has the ring of truth to it. Our view of the story of Hanukkah is very much shaped by the way the Rambam in particular presents it. Even if we never read the Rambam before, but you know, subconsciously the Rambam's formulation of the story of Hanukkah has crept into the way the story is usually recounted. The Rambam writes as follows, the beginning of the third parak of Hilchas Chanukah. B'bayis sheni kishemalchu Yavon, during the period of the second Beis HaMikdash, when the Greeks ruled over the Jews, gazru gzeiros al Yisrael, they made decrees against the Jews, ubit ludosam, and they tried to eradicate our religion. They didn't allow us to engage in Torah and mitzvahs, okay? And bad things happened until God had pity on us. And he delivered us from the hands of the Greeks. The Chashmonoim were victorious over the Greeks. And they saved the Jewish people from the hands of the Greeks. They appointed a king from the Kohanim. And then the Malchus, the kingdom, returned, in other words, independence, sovereignty, returned itself to Jewish hands over 200 years until the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, of the second Beis Hamikdash. So parenthetically, where did the Rambam get that phrase, over 200 years from? It's directly out of Seder Olam. Right? Seder Olam says 206 years from the beginning of the Malchus Beis Chashmonoi until the destruction of the second Beis Hamikdash. So says the Rambam, he rounds it off. So over 200 years transpired from the time that the Chashmonoim took over until the second Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. The impression you get from the Rambam is that the events of Hanukkah coincided with Jewish independence. In other words, when the Jews came into the Beis HaMikdash and they cleaned it up and the miracle of the menorah happened and they started bringing karbanos over again, they also kicked the Greeks out of Eretz Yisrael, they established their monarchy, and basically everybody lived happily ever after, at that point in time. That's certainly when we go back to those Hanukkah plays, which, I mean, that's the way it is. They come in, they kick out the Greeks go by, and now, they fly the Chashmonoi flag, over Eretz Yisrael, and boom, independence has been restored, and the Malchus Beis Chashmonoi starts from that point. That actually is made explicit in a very interesting book called Megillas Antiochus, the Megillah of Antiochus. The Megillah of Antiochus was something which was certainly in its present form written during the Middle Ages and was laned in many Italian shuls on Hanukkah, kind of like Megillas Esther. In fact, in a very interesting decision, I'm not sure what prompted him to do this, if you look in the old Birimbam Sidurim, which you can still find in some places, like Bialystok or Shul. If you look in the old Birimbam Sidurim, in the complete Siddur, he gives you the entire Megillas Antiochus in Hebrew and English translation. Why he does that, I have no idea, because I'm not aware to this day of any Shul that both uses the Birimbam Siddur and lanes Megillas Antiochus on Hanukkah. But I guess he was a scholar, so I guess he thought it would be of scholarly interest to reproduce Megillas Antiochus in the Siddur. If you look at Megillas Antiochus, which again tells the story of Hanukkah, and by the way, if you read it, it's very different than the way we usually tell over the story of Hanukkah. Yehuda Maccabee dies in the first battle against the Greeks and is never heard of again for the rest of the Megillah. So in other words, Yehuda Maccabee doesn't play a major role in the story of Hanukkah according to Megillas Antiochus, which is interesting. By this time the Hanukkah play is going to undergo so much revision. Yeah, exactly. So at the end of the Megillah, the Jews come into the Beis HaMikdash. They clean it up. They start the karbanos. They have the miracle of the oil, and they decide to implement Hanukkah. From that time on, I'll read you the English, the Greek government was stripped of its renown. I mean, pretty clear, it's hard to imagine he means the entire Greek government all over the world, because there certainly still was a Greek empire after the events of Hanukkah, but at least in Eretz Yisrael, they were tossed out, lo hayo shem lemalchus yavon. They had no renown anymore. Vayekablu hamalchus b'nei Chashmonoi, the children of Chashmonoi, the Hasmoneans, accepted the malchus. Heim uvneim uvnei v'neim, they, their children, their children's children. Me'o'es hazos ad churban beiso elokim, from this time until the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, mosayim v'sheish shonim. right? 206 years, again, exactly, you know, exactly as said in Seder Olam. So basically, the Megillus Antiochus makes it very, very clear the 206 years start from the events of Hanukkah. However, writes Rabbi Goldworm, as much as that's what's explicit in the Megillus Antiochus, and that's the impression you get from the Rambam, that doesn't actually seem to be the historical truth as borne out by the Book of Maccabees. Now, let me be very, you know, make this point very, very clearly. We don't have a problem saying that there's something not 100% accurate in Megillus Antiochus, right? Even though there seems to be a tradition that it was written by Mattathiahu's five sons, it seems clear that maybe the basic idea might have been composed by the five sons of Mattathiahu, but clearly some of the events which are described therein are hard to really reconcile with the story the way we know it. I mean, witness the fact Yehuda Maccabee is killed early on in the battle.
But I remember learning, when I was learning Jewish history, Yehuda was the first one who was killed.
Well, he was the first one who was killed, but he does seem to have been involved in the reconquest of the Beis HaMikdash. Meaning, the way they put it in Megillus Antiochus was, they go out for the first battle and he gets killed right away. You know, he doesn't even see the miracle of Hanukkah, right, which is not the way we generally assume. We generally assume, I mean, again, based on the Book of Maccabees, that he's part of the victory of reconquering the Beis HaMikdash, and that he actually kind of rules over the Jewish people for a short period of time, and then is killed. Yeah, he does get killed, but is killed after the victorious events of Hanukkah. With the Rambam, we'd be much more hesitant to cast aspersions on the Rambam, but what we're saying is not really that the Rambam is not depicting it accurately, but rather that we're not understanding the Rambam accurately. The Rambam is giving a telescoped view of history, right? The purpose of the Rambam in Mishneh Torah was not to write a history book. The purpose of the Rambam was to give you the basic outline and to tell you, you know, this is the reason we celebrate Hanukkah. So, yes, there were decrees against the Jewish people. Yes, the Jewish people rebelled and retook the Beis HaMikdash and cleaned it up. And yes, they ended up appointing a king from the Kohanim who would then set in motion a dynasty that would last for over 200 years. But the Rambam doesn't tell us explicitly that all of those events happened right at the same time. In fact, says Rabbi Goldworm, if you read the Book of Maccabees carefully, what seems to happen is as follows. The Jews take over the Beis HaMikdash, they reinstitute the Karbanos, the miracle of the Nes Pach HaShemen, the miracle of the oil takes place at that time, and the Greeks are still very much in control of Eretz Yisrael. In fact, Yehuda, as much as he assumes the role of leader among the Jewish people, is never appointed king. His successor, Yochanan, is never appointed king. His successor, Yonasan, the third of the brothers, is never appointed king. We don't find that anyone is appointed to an official role of leadership until Shimon, who's, again, the last of the four brothers to actually be raised up to a role of leadership, is appointed to some kind of position of prominence. Let me read to you the citation from the Book of Maccabees, where we're told as follows. Get you the citation. On the 23rd of Iyar, the people of the Akra left Yerushalayim. Right, the Akra was, I mean, it's still in place today. It's a citadel right near the Har HaBayis, where the Chashmonaim, where the Greeks still had a presence through the time of Yehuda, through the time of Yochanan, through the time of Yonasan, who all were the leaders of the Jewish people afterwards. Right? Until then, they had oppressed the people of Yerushalayim, who could not come or go in and out of the Beis HaMikdash during the day, only at night. In other words, they had control of the Beis HaMikdash, but they couldn't even leave the Har HaBayis. They couldn't leave the Beis HaMikdash, except they had to sneak out like thieves in the middle of the night. They really did not have control over the area of Yerushalayim. And it was only when the Malchus Beis HaShmonai grew strong that they expelled them from the Akra. And the book of Maccabees says that on the 18th of Elul, in the year 140 BCE, the people of Yehuda, the Kohanim, and the Sanhedrin put together a general assembly and acknowledged Shimon as their their prince. Just want to read you the Lashon. Because the Lashon over here is very significant. One second. This is the 18th of Elul in the secular year 140 BCE. They engraved on brass pillars and set on pillars on Mount Zion the following, all of the achievements that Shimon had achieved on behalf of the nation. When the people saw Shimon's faithfulness and the prestige he brought his people, they made him their prince, their Nasi, and their Kohen Gadol. And the Jews and the Kohanim resolved that Shimon should remain their prince and Kohen Gadol until a true prophet should appear. Right? So the two things which are significant over here. First of all, Shimon is the first of the brothers, the first member of the Malchus Beis Hashmonoi to be appointed in any royal fashion. And even then, he's not a melech. They're very careful to call him a nasi, to call him a prince. So Rabbi Goldworm suggests the following. The contradiction which we spoke about in terms of the dating, the fact that Maccabees dates the miracle of Hanukkah as taking place in 165, and the fact that the Seder Olam describes the Hashmonai dynasty as starting in 139, can be resolved in the following way. Basically, when the Jews took back the Beis HaMikdash and had the miracle of Hanukkah, that was not the beginning of the dynasty of the Hashmonaim. It was another 26 years before they could even think of appointing someone to be a leader from the Malchus Beis Hashmonai Shimon. And even when they do that, he's only a Nasi, a prince, not a Melech. Up until that time, for those 26 years, the reason there was no Malchus Beis Hashmonai was because basically the Jews really had no political sovereignty whatsoever over Eretz Yisrael. They hadn't even thrown the Greeks entirely off of the Har HaBayis. And they certainly didn't have any kind of control over Eretz Yisrael as a whole. The book of Maccabees goes on to describe how even after the miracle of Hanukkah, Yehuda Maccabee is fighting wars against the Greeks in Eretz Yisrael because they attempt to come back. You know, I mean, the Greeks weren't going to be just thrown out of the Beis HaMikdash like that. They mounted an army, attempted to come back, and he had to fend them off. And his successors, Yochanan and Yonasan, had to defend off the Greeks as well. It's only really 26 years later that when Shimon is appointed finally to be the Nasi over the Jews, that there's a certain degree of political independence which the Jews are able to achieve. When the Rambam writes that the Jews were victorious in recapturing the Beis HaMikdash and reestablishing the Seder HaAvodah, the sacrificial service, and being Ma'amid a Melech Min HaKohanim and establishing a dynasty, the Rambam means, and 26 years after they got back the Beis HaMikdash, they also were successful in reestablishing a dynasty. There's a 26 year gap in what the Rambam is describing. Again, the Rambam makes it sound like it all happened, you know, at once, and the play makes it sound like it all happened at once, and Megillas Antiochus says it all happened at once, but, you know, when you look back at the history, it doesn't contradict the Rambam. The Rambam isn't interested in giving you exact dates, but he's telling you that over the course of a period of time, these various events took place. So everything's resolved, right? In other words, the miracle taka took place in 165, the way that the book of Maccabees describes it, and there was a duration of 206 years from the beginning of the Malchus Beis Hashmonai until the Churban, because we start counting the dynasty of the Hashmonaim from Shimon, not from Yehuda Maccabee. Now, this has a tremendous point in Hashkafa. I mean, you know, once you get through all the numbers and all of that, there's a tremendous Hashkafic point over here. Rabbi Goldwer makes it very explicit. Hanukkah has nothing to do with the political independence of the Jews. It has nothing to do with establishing an independent Jewish kingdom or commonwealth in Eretz Yisrael. Because those events didn't happen till 26 years after the Hanukkah story took place. Mm-hmm. Hanukkah celebrates one thing and one thing only, the fact that the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash was restored. Right? It has nothing to do with now we became an independent state. And in fact, 26 years later, when the Jews did become, you know, semi-independent, when they did create their own dynasty, we're told the date on which that happened. Yud Ches Elul, Chai Elul, right? Chai Elul may have significance in other aspects of Jewish life, but has nothing to do, we don't celebrate Chai Elul as the beginning of the Hasmonean dynasty. We just don't. We don't do anything special on that day to commemorate Jewish independence. So look at the Hashkafa over here, right? The restoration of Jewish independence and a monarchy, basically, for the point of view of history, goes without notice. And, you know, really has nothing to do with Yehuda Maccabee, it has to do with Shimon Maccabee, who, okay, was a big tzaddik, was a Kohen Gadol, who's recognized, but I mean, certainly, you know, doesn't have the same kind of prominence. You know, kid gets told in the play, there's going to be Shimon. You know, he feels bad. You know, he wants to be Yehuda, you know, Matisyahu at least, you know. But, you know, the only thing that Hanukkah celebrates is the fact that now we have the Avodah again. You know, the Greeks are still on the Har HaBayis. They won't let us leave the Beis HaMikdash by day. We have to sneak out at night if we want to go somewhere. We don't have independence, but we have the Avodah and the Beis HaMikdash back again. And it's really just a reiteration of what we're going to lay in the Haftarah this Shabbos. Lo b'chayu v'lo b'koach ki'im b'ruchi. You know, we're not celebrating the victory and the military strength. You know, it's all about ruchi, it's all about my spirit, the restoration of the spirituality, the ability to have the Beis HaMikdash in our hands once again, and to start bringing karbanos once again, is what we're celebrating, pure and simple. Even, you know, we talk sometimes about the fact that, you know, the main thing is the spiritual restoration of the Beis HaMikdash, not so much the military victory. That's true, and now we can understand that on a deeper level even. The military victory, from a military point of view, wasn't that significant. I mean, you know, it was significant in the sense that they got back the Beis HaMikdash, and, you know, the victory stopped the Greeks from enforcing the anti-Jewish decrees. But, and so this he points
that,
out...
Isn't that enough? I mean, that's a big...
But that's the point. In other words, it's not celebrating the fact that we threw the Greeks out of Eretz Yisrael, because that didn't happen till a quarter century later. Right? The Greeks, from a political point of view, it was a very limited victory.
They stopped fighting them.
Well, the Greeks kept coming back and fighting again. Right, but at least now they had the Beis HaMikdash. By the way, the anti-Semitic decrees were still on the books until Antiochus' successor, Antiochus of the story is Antiochus IV, until his successor, Antiochus V, the laws are still on the books, but just because the Jews have gained the upper hand around the Beis HaMikdash, the Greeks no longer have the ability to enforce those laws. But the laws are not repealed. You know, I mean, they made laws, they have to repeal the laws. The laws are not going to be repealed until the next Greek king, the next Syrian Greek king, comes on the throne. So in other words, again, not to minimize the, you know, the fact that they had back, you know, that they were able to throw off the anti-Greek laws, but the point is, it's not about, you know, yes, we won and now we have control over Eretz Yisrael. That would have been a purely physical victory, and that, when it happens 26 years later, is not cause for celebration. The one thing which makes the holiday L'dorei Doros for generations thereafter is the fact that the Beis HaMikdash was originally not in our hands, and now it's back in our hands, and now we can celebrate without any outside interference, that we can keep the Jewish religion, we can keep Torah and Mitzvahs without any outside interference. It gives us a greater appreciation for the importance of the centrality of the spiritual component of Hanukkah, and really helps us minimize the degree to which we're celebrating the military or the political victory of Hanukkah. That didn't even happen at that particular time.
If you say that, then what year, let's say, I mean, if this is over, what year did Hashem give us the Torah then?
No, it doesn't impact on that. It doesn't impact on that. Because it just it doesn't impact on that. In other words, you know, the dates are all intact. The chiddush of Rabbi Goldworm, which he says he presented to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and he was maskim, he agreed to this, was that we oftentimes think that the celebration of Hanukkah and the end of Greek sovereignty over Eretz Yisrael happened at the same time. No, there's a 26-year gap between those two events. And, you know, a quarter century went by where they were basically still under Greek rule. It's just that they had the Beis HaMikdash in their hands and were able to, you know, to control it and to make sure that the Avodas HaKarbonos, the sacrificial service, was still ongoing. Again, the history gives us a kind of unique insight into HaShkafa. One final point, and this we'll try to wrap up with this. We just cited this citation from the Book of Maccabees where the Jews decided that finally they're going to appoint a ruler. So they appoint Shimon to be the Nasi until a true prophet should appear. So why did they make him a Nasi and not a Melech? And what's the reference to until a true prophet should appear? So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, when this was presented to him, says the answer is very, very simple. It all goes back to a famous Ramban on Chumash. The Ramban writes that when Yaakov Avinu told, we're going to read in Parshas Vayechi in a few weeks, when Yaakov Avinu told his sons, Lo Yosur Shevet Mi Yehuda, Mechokik Mi Ben Raglov, the scepter of kingship shall never depart from Yehuda. So says Rabbi Yaakov, implicitly Yaakov was saying that no one from any other Shevet, from any other tribe, is ever able to be a king. I, the Chashmonaim, were kings, and they were from Shevet Levi. So says the Ramban, you're right, that was a problem. They sinned in doing that, and that's why ultimately the Hasmonean kingdom collapsed in ruins, you know, and fell apart in a very kind of disgraceful fashion, because they ignored the dictum of Yaakov Avinu, Loyosu Shevet Mi Yehuda Mechokim Ben Raglov. So says Rabbi Yaakov, if you look back at the Book of Maccabees, it seems that whatever criticism the Ramban had of the Chashmonaim was only directed at the later generations of Chashmonaim, who assumed the title Melech for themselves. The later Chashmonaim, we know, were very much not observant of Torah and Mitzvahs. In many cases, they persecuted the rabbis. Mm-hmm. However, the first generation of Chashmonaim, Shimon, Shimon was the son of Matisyahu. He had rebelled against the Greeks and stood up for Yiddishkeit. How could he have ignored the dictum of Yaakov Avinu, Lo Yosur Shevet Mi Yehuda? So says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, if you read the Book of Maccabees, right, it's a diuk in the Book of Maccabees from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, if you read the Book of Maccabees carefully, you see that he didn't ignore the Ramban at all. They made Shimon not a melech. They made a nasi until a true prophet comes for Israel. Meaning, when Moshiach comes, so then we'll restore the Malchus based David, the real kings that come from the house of David. But until that time, we need leaders. You know, we can't just sit around and wait and not have anybody lead the Jewish people. All right, so you know what, Shimon? You'll be a Nasi. You'll be a prince. You can't be a Melech, because Lo Yosur Shevet Mi Yehuda. So you'll be a Nasi. And in fact, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, the very Book of Maccabees shows you that they were concerned about this point, which the Ramban would bring out explicitly years later. I mean, the Ramban lived many years after the Book of Maccabees was composed. But reading the Book of Maccabees carefully, you can see that point, which the Ramban was already attuned to. Right? That Lo Yosur Shevet Mi Yehuda means you can't have a Melech from any other Shevet other than Shevet Levi. Right? So they bedavka made Shimon into a Nasi because they realized that as much as the events of Hanukkah and the aftermath were significant, but it's not yet the ultimate geula, it's not yet the ultimate redemption. We're still hoping and praying for that. So that's a tremendous hashkafa. In addition to being a very fascinating interpretation of the history, right, it's also a tremendous hashkafa. Part of what we're supposed to see in Hanukkah is that Hanukkah is not the ultimate redemption. It's supposed to give us the koach and the ability to yearn for the ultimate redemption. What happened then is supposed to give us hope that even in the darkest of times in Jewish history, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends us a little bit of light. We haven't seen in the events of Hanukkah, the Geula has not yet come, but we remain confident that throughout the events of Jewish history, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is constantly sending us little Hanukkahs, little lights to light up the darkness. Halavai, in the schus of our celebrating those lights that light up the darkness, we should see the final Geula, when the Prophet comes for Israel, and when the Nesiim are transformed into Malachim. I wish everybody a Freilich and Chanukah. I think next week, look, COVID Chanukah, we'll have a Chanukah break. People are having Chanukah Mesibas. People need time to chazer over the material, you know, that's good. So we'll pick up Ezra Hashem the Monday following that, and then, you know, continue regularly with the Kuzari.